Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, I said like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
Robbie Krieger joined The Doors in 1965 as a 19-year-old kid. He wrote Light My Fire, along with a catalog of brilliant songs that you know by heart, that we all know by heart. Robbie Krieger has a new memoir out called Set the Night on Fire that stands apart from other rock and roll memoirs because of the kindness with which he approaches his own story, his memories, the feuds with his bandmates, the misportrayals of Hollywood, and other books that have come out over the years. He is a deep thinker. He's a very chill guy. And all of that comes across in this interview. I'm so grateful that I got to speak with him for Wheels Off. And I highly recommend that you either read or listen to, or both, Robbie Krieger's new memoir, Set the Night on Fire. Such a good dude, such an interesting guy. It was tricky making the recording work of the Zoom. You know, it's lining up schedules and then the technology. I think throughout you may hear a beeping in the background of where he is. I never really pressed him on it because it had been so hard just getting everything to come together to begin with. So you may not notice it. It may drive you crazy. I don't think it will be the latter. I think it's pretty low key. Robbie Krieger is great, and I'm so honored to get to speak to him. A life in rock and roll, unlike any lived by anyone else I can even think of. Who else is Robbie Krieger? You kidding me? This guy's incredible. And he's on Wheels Off. So please welcome to Wheels Off, the great Robbie Krieger. Welcome to Wheels Off, Robbie Krieger. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem.
This is so great for the edification of our listeners. Where are you right now?
I'm home in L.A. Just got back from New York, where we did some shows.
Oh, very cool. Where did you play in New York?
Well, in New York City, at the Sony Hall, it's called. Nice. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's this weird place. It's like underground, like two stories underground, but it's a big theater. It's kind of cool.
That sounds pretty cool. I really appreciate you taking the time. I should tell you that I loved your book so much. It was so well written and so thoughtful. And man, it gave me all sorts of, you know, feelings. I got to say, I found myself getting choked up and teary-eyed more than once. It was really beautifully done.
Wow, that's cool. Thanks so much.
So I always begin these conversations by wondering what it is, what creative project are you working on at the moment, and how does it light you up?
Well, we're just starting to play some shows right now, and we're going to play the Whiskey for the first time in a couple of years, next week, or in December 4th, actually. And we're putting out a new LA Woman box set because it's the 50th anniversary of that.
Wow.
And I also have an album coming out. It's kind of reggae. Instrumental reggae album.
Wow.
It's called Vox versus versus Dub.
That's crazy. You in the book, you spent some time in Jamaica back in the day. Is it a place you've visited a lot over the years?
Yeah, I've been there a few times. I love Jamaica. Yeah, mainly for the music.
Sure.
You know, it's it was kind of crazy when we first went there. It was right after the Miami thing, you know.
And, yeah, it seemed like that was a seminal trip.
Yeah, we were supposed to be going on a tour right after that. So we did the Miami thing. Everything was fine. Nobody got arrested. The cops were upstairs having beers with us, in fact. So then we went to Jamaica just for a few days just to hang out before the tour. And we get back and we hear no more tour. Jim got charged with all these felonies, and so that was a surprise.
Yeah, hearing that story and the way that the fallout from that Miami gig and the trumped up charges and all that, it seemed like that was, you know, that was like a really pivotal moment in the band, and even in for Jim. I mean, it seemed like that must have been a hard thing for all of you guys to weather that insane, stupid thing.
Yeah, it was maybe meant to be, but I don't know. I mean, you know, he probably would have pulled his pants down if our road manager hadn't been holding right behind him, holding his pants up. But it never happened, you know, that's the point.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that you've got all this new music coming out, and that's obviously you're not resting on your laurels. I wonder, for you to go back to the whiskey, a stage that you've got such a history with, you know, all these years later, is it just, does it feel like ghosts when you go back there, or is it just a place that you've worked over the years so many times, it's just like going back to it, it's pretty regular?
Yeah, I mean, I play there an average of once every couple of years, you know. So it's not like a real nostalgic or anything, but it's still cool. You know, it's, they got one of my paintings hanging in there, and, it's, you know, it's obviously the place where we started, and it was the beginning of our career. So it's kind of, you know, known as the Doors place.
Can you tell me a little about the book and how it came together and what it was like for you to write it and revisit it? Because like I said, I've read a handful of these rock memoirs, and I feel like yours was a lot more thoughtful, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was more well done than most of these.
Oh, thanks so much. Appreciate that. Yeah, I had read a bunch of them too, and I just wanted it to be different. You know, I actually started writing it about 25 years ago, when John and Ray had written their books. But then what happened was, you know, those two books made a lot of problems between the three of us, and ended up with a lawsuit and all that stuff. So I just kept putting it off.
In a way, maybe it was cool that you waited a while to do it, because you were able to not only sort of address all the books and movies that had come out and give your own side of the story, but it was kind of sweet that you had this perspective where you, in a lot of ways, were able to, you know, put a lot of the negativity to rest. I thought that was really cool the way you handled it all.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe it was better that I waited, you know. So I think it all worked out for the best.
You talk a lot about it in the book, and I'm hoping obviously that our listeners all go out and read it or listen to the audiobook, which, by the way, I listened to the audiobook And it was super well done. Though the problem was that you're missing all the great pictures unless you figure out the PDF situation. But you know, I wonder, because you did get such a young start. I wonder, can you pinpoint a moment where you knew that you were going to make a life in music or in rock and roll? For you, was there like an epiphany moment early on?
I think it was when I was in high school, and I was playing guitar most of the time, you know, in school rather than studying. But and we formed this jug band, you know, and I just love music. And at one point I was with this girlfriend, and I said, you know what, I'm going to be a musician. And she said, really? You really believe that? I go, yep. That was it. Couldn't break that promise.
I have a couple of teenage kids, and they would say that you were manifesting. That's the big word they use now. You were manifesting.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I think it's when you say something to the universe and it becomes real because you said it.
Yeah, that could be. that's actually in the book. So.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I mean, it's such a fascinating story because, you know, I just spoke to a novelist the other day who didn't put out her first novel till she was into her 40s. And then here you were, you know, already had a massive rock and roll career by the time you were 25 or whatever. Like I wonder, looking back on it, does the youth seem like it was a necessary part of the equation? Does it seem like it was something where you wished in a way you'd been a little older so you could appreciate it more, or just it is what it is? Like, what was it like to be so young when it was all happening?
Well, I never thought of that. I mean, it just seemed normal to me, you know, at the time. I mean, looking back, I was 19 when I wrote Light My Fire.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And, maybe I do wish I was older because it was, you know, after Jim passed away, it was really tough to keep going and not just give it up and say, hey, I'm just going to do something else. You know, we had no idea that 50 years later, people would still be into the Doors.
Boy, it really is a testament to the music, right? And it's funny reading, because I spoke with John for Wheels Off, and it was interesting, but to hear your stories about writing all these songs, as a songwriter myself, I just feel like that's such a magical thing. And I love the way you describe it in the book. And I'm glad that you stuck with it. And now to be doing it and putting out new records all these years later, does it still feel like it's the same thing to sit down and write a song?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, obviously it was a lot easier when you have Jim Morrison as a song. He's a songwriter guy with you. But it's something you have to keep doing, you know. So you write songs?
Oh yeah. So I sing in a band. This is my main thing. Apparently at some point a few years ago it became obligatory that everyone in entertainment has to host a podcast, and they told me but I only do this because I love the idea of talking to creative people about how they do it, how they get through the weird stuff, which is one thing I really loved about your book, is that you're really candid about, you know, the stuff you went through, about your own mental health, about, you know, the hardships that you dealt with, not even just external, but like the internally generated stuff, which is the thing that in these Wheels Off conversations is the thing that I find the most illuminating, is how people confront they're internally generated obstacles, right? Like the stuff that the stories we tell ourselves to keep ourselves down, or the negative voices in our head. And I really appreciated how you talked about that in the book. And I wonder if you could just describe for our listeners, when you run into that kind of negative interior stuff, what have you figured out over the years in terms of strategies to get through that, past it?
I don't know. For me, it's just, what else would I do? You know, I don't know how to do anything else. So, and to me, it's just, it's always fun. And it's, you know, and it's fun to write with other people. And although, you know, like I say, it's tough to beat writing with Jim Morrison. But, you know, I've found quite a few other writing friends that are, that really helps, you know. So it's something I just wouldn't ever stop doing.
You talk about, and this comes up a lot with when I talk with creative folks, you talked about your early experiences with meditation and as a way of sort of just dealing with the noise in your head. Is that something that's still a part of your life and routine?
Yeah, I do it almost every day still. And, you know, it's, you know, I don't expect to reach samadhi or whatever it is in your particular religion, but I think it just feels like a natural thing to me to go back. It's like going back to the roots, you know, because when you meditate, you hopefully communicate with the cosmos, and you go back to the beginning, is what it is. And otherwise you're just floating out there with no connection whatever you want to call it, to God or to what Maharishi used to call it,
the unified field, or the one.
Yeah. That type of thing, yeah.
Do you, it comes up a lot, the idea that what we do on stage or when we're writing songs is similar to meditation, or even maybe like an act of meditation in and of itself. Do you find that when you play guitar, when you stand on a stage, when you write a song, does it correlate? Does it kind of feel like you're meditating or in a state like that?
Yeah, definitely. And it's the same when you're playing golf.
That's right.
I do a lot. You know, the best, when you play the best, it's like, it's kind of automatic. You know, you don't get in your own way. And that's kind of easy to do, you know, if you're not paying attention. So, yeah, like in music, you got to put it on automatic pilot. And you know, not think too much, you know. It's the same with meditation, teaches you to do that, I think.
It's funny, I like in Set the Night on Fire when you talk about how in the Doors songs you would always leave one section that was, I forget what you call it, like the open-ended section, or the, like there was no map, like there was gonna be a section where you were just gonna figure it out in that moment. And that you describe it never being the same. I love that. I think that's really cool. Obviously, that's important to you, right? That kind of openness.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I know all these guys that are in these Doors tribute bands. Two of which are roadies on when we go out and play the Doors stuff. And they're always saying, "Hey, you didn't play that solo right, you know." You didn't. And I go, "Hey, man, it was never the same every time. It was always different, you know." And they just don't understand that.
So funny. I love that. And you still do, right? When you're doing this stuff, it's always like you have a section where you get to just make a whole new thing every night, right?
Yeah. You know, and a lot of times I'll try to do the, you know, the signature licks or whatever.
Yeah.
But then I go off on a different plane. And I don't know if people love it or hate it, but to me, if it was the same exact thing every night, it would be boring.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wonder, you know, I feel like there's already just been a lot of great wisdom in this conversation we've had, and certainly Set the Night on Fire is chock full of, I feel like, really actionable, good stuff, useful wisdom. But I wonder if you would mind sort of distilling some of this wisdom for us. If you were to run into a 21-year-old version of Robbie Krieger, but in today's world, what advice do you think you might give yourself?
Maybe don't get married so early. Because I've been with my wife now for 50 years. We just had our 50th.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so it worked out pretty well. But it took a while to even things out, you know. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of glad. Often I think, oh, I should have learned to read music, you know, when I was younger. And I'm actually kind of glad I didn't, because I think that helped me write songs, because, you know, I know so much more about music now that it's harder to, you know, you write something and you say, oh, that's too simple. You know, I should have used some other, you know, fancier chords or something like that. But back then I didn't know anything. So everything was new, you know.
Boy, you describe one of the songs. I'm trying to think if it was Light My Fire. There's a chord progression, and you go through it in the book where you're breaking all these rules, right? You're doing all these things. Was it Light My Fire?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's what you're describing. And I totally agree with this. I remember learning the circle of fifths and being mad, wishing I'd never learned, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. But yeah. The way you describe it is so great, right? Like you broke like every rule and used every chord that you weren't supposed to. But how great was it? I mean, you know, as George Draculius always told me, you can't argue with the sales. Like the song turned out great, and rules be damned.
Yeah, exactly. you know, the first thing I wrote on Light My Fire was the what is now the intro, which has Ray doing the Bach stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, before he did the Bach stuff, I had these chords, and I just wanted to use all the crazy chords that I never would think of using, just for fun, you know. So it's like okay, G, D, F, B flat, E flat, A flat, A. You know, whoever uses those chords together. And so when Ray heard it, he, you know, it was just a way to get out of the solo back into the song, you know, and he didn't have any of that Bach stuff on it yet. So that took, you know, months and months of playing it every night. And he would add a little bit here, a little bit there. And, you know, in the movie, they show him saying, okay, you guys go out to the beach while I write this, you know, and took him half an hour. Yeah, it wasn't like that.
Yeah, I thought you were pretty even-handed and kind, like, you know, throughout the book, but especially in your description of the movie. But I did appreciate that you were able to point out, because I do think it's important to demystify to folks. Like, it's not like it is in movies. And if kids are starting a band right now, they might feel like they could never be the Doors because they can't do a half an hour and come up with what Ray came up with on that song. But what you're saying right now is so useful. I hope kids know that, right? That,
yeah, for sure. I mean, it takes, you know, we were very lucky because we were able to play every night for months and develop those songs, you know. Where so many bands today will play maybe once a week and if they're lucky. And then they try to make an album and, you know, they have to make most of the stuff up during recording, which is not easy.
Yeah, or build it on a Pro Tools session.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, I think it's so cool. I really think that your life in rock and roll and the way that you described it in the book, I just think it's really a generous thing. And I hope everybody goes out and reads it because it's more than just about your life in the Doors. It's you know, it's a really thoughtful book. I've got a son as well. I've got my son reads a lot of books that are like spirituality books or self-help kind of books. And I keep wanting to tell him, like, if you read like a book like Set the Night on Fire or a book like a really great novel, there's stuff in it where you learn so much, and it's not technically called a self-help book, but yeah, there you are.
So what does Wheels Up mean?
I have friends of mine would always use that as an expression to describe, I think it goes back to some sort of a car race thing, but when the wheels are flying off and the car is falling apart or something like that. It's when things get weird, basically.
Okay. I thought it was more like an airplane thing.
Oh yeah. That would be Wheels Up, which might be better marketing. I've never been great at marketing.
That's pretty cool.
Well, Robbie, man, I think you're such an inspiration, and I love the fact that I've gotten to talk to you, and thanks for letting me pick your brain. And thanks so much. And like I said, I hope everybody goes and reads the book because it's fucking great. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much. And I got to give credit to my co-writer, Jeff Alulis, who I probably would never have finished the damn book if it weren't for him. So,
well, if you don't mind my asking, because you guys took a really cool approach to, of course, I'm restarting the interview now, sorry. You took a really cool approach to the way that you used like the chronology of it. Like you open with, you know, you jump around a lot.
It's not just chronological. Well, we both kind of talked about that in the beginning. And I was just watching some movie and which did the same thing, you know, and I always like it when movies do that, where they have a lot of flashbacks, you know, because it makes it more interesting to me.
It almost makes it like a mystery novel in a way, where you'll tease something and then you'll go somewhere else for a long time. And then the reader is wanting to know, well, what's going to happen with that thing? And then you come back to it chapters later.
Right.
It really works. It's so great.
It made it more fun to write too.
Yeah, man. Well, Robbie, thank you so much. This is great. Good luck with the records. Woo!
All right. Good talking to you, man.
You too. Take care, Robbie. Bye.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
We're going to be like Chicago.
Get down!
The wrath of the
Buzzer. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.